behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bull.
And we are back with part two of our Jeep brand podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, we've had a lot to cover already. We've already talked about just a little bit about the Jeep brand itself, the history,
sure.
The design.
The name.
Lots about the war, mm-hmm. You know, the effort to put this whole thing together and how they did it so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it seems like we just barely got into the civilian versions, right? I mean, we were starting to talk about the CJ models.
Yep.
And we were... do we even talk about dispatch models or any of that yet? I don't think we did.
We just mentioned how the versatility of the military Jeep could also translate to the civilian world, but maybe we should start with dispatch today.
Yeah, and one other thing, and I just remembered this, you know, in the last episode we were talking about Ford and how Ford had decided at the end of the war to stop producing its version of the Jeep.
Because right, yeah.
Ford was building Jeep vehicles, believe it or not. If you haven't listened to the first podcast, you should to find out, you know, how that all worked together. But
right, they were building the Pygmy.
Yeah, they were building the Pygmy version, I guess, of it. And Ford, you know, how they all three had come together. Remember Bantam, Ford, and Willys?
Yep.
Well, they all had their own ideas that came together. And just as an interesting, again, another historical side note, the slotted grill on the front of the Jeep, you know, with the round headlights and the slotted grill.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually a Ford design that was a carryover into, you know, the Willys product, you know, the one that they continued to build after the war and the one that mm-hmm. they trademarked after the war.
Oh.
So think about this, Ben, you know, that distinctive Jeep, I think it's a 7-slot grill now that they use with the round headlights.
Yeah.
That design was something that's carryover from Ford. So if they had stuck with it, that would have been a kind of a Ford signature item on a vehicle rather than a Jeep signature item.
You know, what's so strange about this is that I know we talked about this fact in our previous episode, but Scott, you still have to stop and marvel when you consider how rare it is for these three different companies, completely different companies, to be given the same set of design and spec requirements and then be able to work together. Constantly doing that, I have to wonder, you know, it's happened before. Oops, sorry, it's happened before with some other vehicles, but not often. And
well, this is for the greater good, you know. It was a time of war, where I mean, war was imminent at that point,
mm-hmm.
and they knew that it's for the best. I mean, you got to put all of that other stuff aside. You can't be in competition with somebody, you know, during that time. You've got to work together just to make this work, because otherwise, you know, we all lose, really.
Yeah.
And that's really the sentiment that this all came down to, and saying that, you know, we've got to make this one design work, and we've got to work together as a team, and that's just the way it has to be. And they did it well. I mean, what they came up with was a great solution, and they ended up building, what did you say, 700,000 vehicles together?
Yeah, in 4 years.
I mean, Ford and Willys, and of course Bantam was responsible for the initial design, I guess, so they had a lot to do with it as well. Interesting history. I mean, the history of this thing is really, really incredible. It's very, very rich. It's very deep, and there's so many little, you know, side notes and
right.
and
one more things.
Yeah, exactly. That yeah. We're trying to cover a few of them here, but really, if you want to dig into this on your own, you'll find some surprising, you know, eyebrow raising items in the history of the Jeep that you just never would have guessed.
Yeah, call your boss, say I have to take the week off because I listen to this podcast about Jeeps, and now I have to know everything they didn't get to. But one thing we will get to, and I'm sorry, Scott, because I know this conversation is going to be so tangential between us today, and I guess we always go into tangents, but that's fine. I'm sorry, because we've been about to talk about dispatches for an episode now.
I guess so, yeah. We're talking about dispatches, and we'll just keep it sort of brief on dispatches, because we were mentioning the Jeep CJ product, right? The
right.
Civilian Jeeps in the last one. And, you know, again, this public version of the military Jeep from World War II. And the CJs were so popular, and by the time 1955 rolled around, they decided that they were going to build these two-wheel drive variants of the four-wheel drive versions of the CJ, and we're going to call them dispatcher vehicles. Now, the dispatcher vehicles are what you would think of, you know, when you think about AMC owning the company, I guess.
Right.
And I'm going to take a quick look at my notes here, just kind of cheat, but in 1955, who owned the Jeep name? I believe it was, Kaiser.
Oh, you beat me to it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I found my note ahead of time, but it was Kaiser, who called themselves Willys Motors at the time.
Yeah.
And so it actually predates the AMC version of the Jeep in 1970, but these dispatcher Jeeps were built through that time when AMC owned them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the vehicles that you would think of as the mail delivery Jeeps.
Yep. The next time your post office vehicle comes by, just peek out the window. I mean, don't be creepy. Maybe just walk out the door and you will notice that is a dispatch Jeep, or it may have been.
It may have been. And the thing is, they built them from like 1955 all the way through 1984, and they were called the DJ version of the Jeep. Mm-hmm. So you know how all these different models have different, I guess, codes ahead of them, body codes.
Right.
And, you know, like we think of, you know, the modern Jeep as JK, as, you know, Mark had mentioned with his Jeep.
Yeah, the JKU.
Yeah, JK. But then there's also the CJ, and there's, the FJ, and there's the J series standalone, the SJs. There's all these different series throughout history, and you have to go back through the timeline to figure out which is which and, you know, what body style is what. But, these dispatch vehicles, which were the DJs, which I guess is easy to remember, the DJs, those are the ones that we associate with the male Jeep models. And kind of tying into this thing, you know, these are some vehicles that appeared around 1959. So right around the same, there was a type of vehicle called the Jeep Surrey. And the Jeep Surrey is maybe a lesser known Jeep model to a lot of people.
Yeah, this is one that was vaguely familiar, but you schooled me on it a little bit.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. If you look up a Jeep Surrey, there's a good chance that you're going to find a vehicle that is if you find a restored one, it would be in sort of a bright color, maybe a pink or maybe like a mint color.
And there's a reason for that.
Yeah, there's a good reason. And if you look at them, you'll quickly understand what they're used for. They're typically used for hotels and resorts to shuttle people back and forth to the beach or maybe just on the property. And they would allow, sometimes they would allow the residents, the people that are renting property to drive these vehicles. They'd be rental vehicles on the property. So instead of renting a golf cart, you would rent a Jeep Surrey vehicle, and you would drive it down to the beach for the day, and that would be kind of your get around the resort vehicle. And they're very distinctive. I mean, again, bright colors. They had a lot of chrome and almost like ornate, almost like a boat would have, you know, like with a lot of chrome accents on them.
Yeah, just kind of touristy.
And maybe the most distinctive thing was they had this canopy top that was a fabric top that was striped. And typically it was like a pink and white stripe. And you can just picture this in your mind. Think about the Fantasy Island vehicles. Now, they used a couple of Jeeps, you know, CJ models, I believe, in Fantasy Island. But I think that the main vehicle that Ricardo Montalban drove was a station wagon that had a canopy top like that. It was a custom-built vehicle, no doors. Mm-hmm. It kind of was meant to be like a lower Jeep type vehicle, I guess, but it was like I think it was a Plymouth Valari station wagon. And then Tattoo had his own little go-kart version, you remember, that looked just like that.
Oh yeah, and Tattoo was the plane boss, the plane
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, Hervé Villachez, I think is his name.
Whoa,
right?
Nice.
Yeah, yeah, he's no longer with us, but,
nice reference,
but interesting, little side note there is that, you know, these Surrey vehicles, if you look them up online, you'll instantly recognize them as resort vehicles.
Can we talk a little bit about the mark of Jeep across the world?
Yes.
Okay, so Jeep, as we know, is super popular in the United States and in the West in general, but that's not where the story ends. Jeep is also popular in other countries, and indeed it's manufactured in other countries, because get this, buddy, we mentioned earlier in episode one that Jeep and its owning company, who is now Fiat, issue these licenses, right?
Sure. Now, the headquarters, just to get this straight, the headquarters for Fiat is in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
Right.
North America, anyways. Fiat North America is in Auburn Hills, Michigan. And then the headquarters for Jeep is and always has been in Toledo, Ohio. Kind of like a separate entity.
And it always will be, because they've got some autonomy there. But, alright, so, in Argentina, they made IKA Jeeps, and for our Australian listeners, Willys Motors in Australia, which was active up until about the 80s. There are some interesting things here. There's a little bit of international crime when it comes to Jeeps.
International crime? I'm intrigued. What's going on?
It's in Burma or Myanmar. Two Burmese companies are producing unlicensed copies of Jeeps.
Wait. Unlicensed copies of Jeep. So they're just outright building Jeep-like vehicles. I'll call them Jeep-like vehicles.
Okay, yeah.
Because they're no doubt of lesser quality.
Right.
So what's how can they just get away with that? I don't understand.
Well, this goes into the tricky world of trade regulations,
international licensing.
Yeah, because you know that can be a big problem for everything from a computer mouse to a satellite. You know.
Oh man,
there's so much. There's reverse
broad
engineering.
Range.
Yeah, but I'm not sure why these haven't been busted down yet. China does have the Beijing Jeep Corporation, which went from 83 to 2009 and is reopening with Fiat Chrysler partnering up with the Guangzhou automobile industry. I think I totally mispronounced that.
That's all right. You know, I've heard of Beijing Jeep many times in the past. And, you know, I think I want to say that when I was working at Chrysler, there was a guy that had driven around the world, Ben.
Whoa.
Like, done one of those trips where, you know, there are places where you have to ferry the vehicle, obviously.
Right.
But he had driven around the world, and I believe it was a Beijing Jeep product that he had driven in.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And it's kind of on display there with everything that he had, taken with him around the world. It was pretty interesting to see. Now, they also make them in India. They make them in Spain, several places in South America. Did you mention Japan? I think in Japan they built them until something like 1998.
Yep.
So these are officially licensed versions of the Jeep that are, the company knows about. The main parent company says, you're going to build them to our standards, and they're going to, you know, you're going to have the Jeep name, but you're also going to have the Jeep quality.
Right, and pay some fees to us. Now, what's interesting is that in Iran, they have vehicles that are not called Wranglers or Wagoneers or the DJs, but they're completely based on them as well.
Copycat vehicles.
Well, I don't know if they're copycats. I think they are, though. Maybe someone can correct me. I want to talk, though, about something that fascinates me that might hopefully fascinate some of our other listeners who are interested in the chicken bus stories from earlier.
Oh, who wouldn't be interested in another chicken bus story? You've got endless chicken bus stories.
Oh, well, this is something like a chicken bus.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And this
That's too
is,
bad.
Yeah. This is the Jeepney. The Jeepney. Have you heard of this?
I have not heard about this.
Okay.
You're catching me off guard here.
I think I'm sorry to put you on the spot. I'm pretty sure that you've heard of this. Maybe not the name, but you'll know what it is when I say it.
Okay.
It's a popular form of public transportation in the Philippines. So in World War II, right, there were a lot of U.S. Operations that were around that theater, right? And in the Philippines.
Sure.
So Jeeps were everywhere, because a lot of Jeeps were just left behind. Now, These Jeeps originally got customized, and then they became very popular in the Philippines. And now they're building larger things that are almost like buses that are public transit in the Philippines. But weirdly enough, they were originally made from U.S. military Jeeps left over from World War II. And, they're so popular. And they're so understood to be public transit that if you have one that's just for, you know, you and your family, the move you do is you put a sign on it that says, like, family only or private.
No kidding, because people hop on, huh?
People just assume, like, oh, you're in a Jeepney.
You gotta watch for the hop on.
Yeah, and there are,
what is that from? That's Arrested Development, right?
Oh man.
They're driving that, remember the staircase for the airliner and they're saying watch for the hop-ons?
Yeah. And other foreign thing that I thought would be interesting is a little different. We'll go across the world to Colombia. There is a Jeep parade in Colombia.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to mispronounce it. Spelled Y-I-P-A-O. Yipao?
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Ben, and I'm going to say that I bet there are Jeep parades elsewhere in the world as well. I mean, that's cool that you found that one, but I'm sure somewhere out there have been other Jeep parades because these are so popular and just being that they're built in so many different places.
Yeah.
You know that, we mentioned Toledo and their pride with the Jeep name and the Jeep product.
Yeah, that's the headquarters.
Exactly right. So, I mean, I would say that, you know, in Beijing or, you know, any of these other places we mentioned, you mentioned Iran, you mentioned, other places in Japan. I would bet that in the cities where these things are built that, you know, there's probably a day when they bring out the new products and have a smaller parade maybe, you know, of Jeep only products.
Oh yeah. Wouldn't it be fun to be in one? And if you think about it, we've talked a lot about the developing world and the affordability of vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeep is one of the, you know, historically is one of the ones that people had a better chance of affording.
Can I tell you something? Since you just said affordability, this is going way back. This is slightly off topic, I guess. When the initial vehicles came out, the initial war vehicles.
Oh, this is cool. Yeah.
Now the final production model Jeeps during the war, you know, these are the wartime Jeeps. So the Willys Overland models, which were called the MB, and then the Ford built models, which were called the GPWs. The price difference really wasn't much between them, but it was very, very low. So the cost per unit of the Willys Overland model, the MB, $648.74. That's all it cost them to build that and get it out onto the field. Well, actually, it cost them to build that. I don't know how much it cost them to ship it out to the field or whatever.
Right,
but,
yeah.
And the Ford-built models were $782.59. So it looks like there's only about a... what is that about? That's $140 between the two, something, roughly.
Multiply that by...
Well, multiply that by 700,000. Right. It depends on how many each brand built, but, thought that was an interesting side note that, you know, for as little as $648.74, they could build a Willys Overland Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, again, the Ford came in at just under $800. So that's not bad at all.
I think that if I recall correctly, I think that Ford manufactured a little more than half of those 700,000.
So the more expensive one, they built more than half.
Well, also they have more production capacity. There's just no way around that.
You know, it's funny, like when you look at them, there's little subtle differences between them. Like I think the Ford version was just a little bit heavier.
Yeah.
It cost a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all have their own little thing. And, you know, the military said, you know, that's fine. You just get them out there in the field. We need 700,000 of these things. So,
right.
So yeah, just start building them and we'll
There's
talk
a
about
world war.
That's yeah, that's right. We'll talk about the differences later.
Yeah, I think that Willys ended up building around 330,000.
It's a good fact.
If I recall it correctly.
That's a good absolute fact that you just gave, Ben. I will I'll look it up and make sure that you're... Nah, never mind. I'm kidding.
It'll come back years later. Okay, now we've mentioned some of Jeep's effects in the world at large. We've also explored, well, we touched on some copycat cars. That's an interesting podcast we have for anyone who wants to hear more about copycat cars in depth. Whew, how did I say that? That was a tongue twister, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Hey, thanks, man. I'm about to rural juror the heck out of this podcast.
Nice work.
So, what I think we need to do now is talk about some of the models that are out there.
Okay, you know what? Well, let's do this quickly because I think we can move on to some of the other things that that people might be interested in as well, like the Rubicon Trail and some of the events that they can cover and things like that. So let's just do the models quickly. You agree with that, maybe?
Yeah, totally.
And we won't go in depth about each one and everything, but there's one that I'd like to kind of mention as a standout, if that's all right.
Okay.
All right. So I looked at the the current Jeep website, you know, Jeep.com, and found out that they have several different models here. And some special editions that I'll just mention real quick. They have, of course, the Cherokee, they have the Compass, the Grand Cherokee, the Patriot, they have the Wrangler, the two-door Wrangler, which is the one we mentioned many times, the four-door Wrangler, which is a relatively newcomer, and then they have something brand new for 2015, which is called the Renegade. And if you don't know anything about the Renegade, check it out. We're not going to go into the specs of that thing right now, but the Renegade is kind of an interesting new vehicle for 2015, so it's all new. As far as limited edition models, they've got several different ones here that will kind of span different lines. Like you can get a vehicle that's in the just for example the Altitude family of vehicles. They call it it's a special edition Altitude model. But you may be able to get, and I'm going to just pick this as an example. Maybe it's not true, but the Compass and the Grand Cherokee, you can get that in the Altitude. Something like that. So for as far as limited edition models, they have the Altitude, they have the Freedom. They have something called the Willys Wheeler, which is kind of cool. They have the Dragon Edition. They have the Rubicon X Edition. They have the Polar Edition. So you can see that within the brand, they've got a lot of variety, right?
Yes.
And one thing that they have here that's kind of a standout, and it has been for many, many years, they have in the Jeep brand lineup, they have an SRT vehicle.
Ooh.
And I always love the SRT vehicles. I think they're so cool. You know,
yeah.
The hopped up version, I guess.
Right.
And this one in particular, the Grand Cherokee, has a 6.4 liter Hemi V8 engine, which is like 470 horsepower. Not bad for a big SUV. 465 pound feet of torque, so it's a strong engine. 0 to 60, and you got to remember the size of the Grand Cherokee. 0 to 60 in 4.8 seconds, You know, that's using launch control, and it's got a lot of different, you know, very advanced systems in it that allow you to do that 0 to 60 in 4.8.
Right.
Mid 13 second quarter mile speed, which is pretty good for, again, a big vehicle, and 160 miles per hour is the top speed. Now, I don't think I would push a Grand Cherokee to 160 ever, but because it's such a big vehicle, I feel like I'm going to tip over in anything. But the SRT in particular, you know, big fat tires, it's squatted down a little bit more. It's got a better feel to it than, you know, the one that's a little bit higher up in the air. That's kind of the standout for me in the Jeep lineup. And the Renegade, which I think is really cool. And, of course, you know, I mentioned already that, you know, my wife and I are looking at the Unlimited, the four-door version, as a potential future buy for us.
Ah, yes. And there are some pros and cons that I'm just going to plant the seed now to revisit this in one of our side notes that's coming up.
Sure.
But before we do that, it's time that we finally talk about something that we just didn't get to in episode one, which was the Rubicon Trail.
Yeah, that has a special tie-in for Jeep and Jeep owners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people will recognize the name. And I just mentioned it in the current model lineup. There's still a Rubicon version of this thing.
Yep.
And so what's the tie-in? Why is it so important? Well, you have to know what the Rubicon Trail is to begin with and where it's located. It's part road and part 4x4 trail. Mm-hmm. It's located in the Sierra Nevadas, so it's a very rugged part of the United States. And it's about 80 miles east of Sacramento and due west of Lake Tahoe. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of exactly where it is. Now, part of the trail is used as testing ground by Jeep. And in fact, you know, the Rubicon variant of the Jeep, as we mentioned, is named after that trail. It's a specific, specific product name that they use because it shows its ruggedness. And as a matter of fact, you know, all of the Jeep vehicles, if you look at, I believe it's on the driver's side fender of the vehicles, it has a badge that says trail rated. Mm-hmm. And it's a small silver badge. And it's not just something that they stick to the side of the vehicle because it looks cool. It says, you know, I think it says trail rated 4x4 or something like that.
Yeah.
And what it does is it proves their capability because all of the Jeep products, you know, one of each of them, has been tested on the Rubicon Trail. It has to be able to pass the Jeep durability test that they put it through. Now, there's five steps in the test that are important, and they have to meet or exceed all of these tests in order to be certified as trail rated. And those five tests are tests for maneuverability, ground clearance, mm-hmm. articulation, traction, and water fording. So every one of the products that is certified as a trail rated Jeep product, which all of them are, I believe, mm-hmm. that means that they've gone through and either met or exceeded all the expectations on that trail. Now that's, that they've passed it. They've been able to conquer the trail. And if you take a look, if you ever go online and take a look at, you know, what Jeep puts their products through on the Rubicon Trail.
Yeah, it's not a cakewalk.
It is intense. I mean, you would look at some of the places that they go through, and you would never, ever believe that a vehicle could go through there. I mean, much less all of the Jeep product line. I mean, mm-hmm. it's amazing. It really is. It's just intense. And, you know, Ben, when you think about it, you know, the Jeeps of the past, they were so much more Spartan and so much more utilitarian than the ones are now. Because now you look at a Jeep that's on the road and it's I'm going to say it's relatively plush inside. I mean, look at a Grand Cherokee, you know, go and mm-hmm. sit in one. Mm-hmm. And then you think, you know, you look at the footage of, you know, what they can accomplish on the Rubicon Trail, and you think, man, I would never guess that this vehicle, which is actually very comfortable to drive in, very easy to, you know, get around town in or whatever, that it's so rugged and it's capable of doing what it does off road. Now, okay, so we've kind of covered a lot of ground here.
Yep.
We've talked about where Jeeps were built in the past, but you said there's also a Jeep capital of the world. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, self-acclaimed Jeep capital of the world.
Oh, okay.
Out there in Ouray, Colorado, which is spelled O-U-R-A-Y. It's earned this reputation because it has so many Jeep roads, and they're rated from easy to very difficult to traverse. So if you are a Jeep driver, you are in hog heaven up there, man. But also, don't be discouraged if you do not own a Jeep, but you find yourself in the Jeep capital of the world, you can easily rent one. Hmm. Because, of course, what kind of capital would it not be? This is also where one of the most famous Jeep events is held.
What's that?
The Jeep Jamboree.
Oh, no kidding. Okay. So, yeah. You know what? Can I talk about Jeep Jamboree in just 1 second?
Yeah,
because you reminded me of one thing.
Yes.
In that town, you had better know about the Jeep Wave. And you do know about the Jeep Wave, right?
This goes back to, okay, so you guys, off air, Scott and I were talking about this before we went in to record. And off air, we were talking just a second about the Jeep Wave and how it actually is a pro and a con for some Jeep owners.
Particularly the Wrangler owners, the Jeep Unlimited model, you know, the off-road versions, I guess, right?
Yeah, what's the Jeep Wave?
Okay, the Jeep Wave is, and this is where Jeep owners, again, primarily, you know, CJ owners, that type of body style.
Right.
They give kind of a little nod or a wave to show that, you know, like the camaraderie, I guess.
Yeah.
You often see, like, Harley riders will do the same thing. You know,
sure.
They'll stick the hand out down below, you know, like with the peace sign or whatever they do. I'm not sure, three fingers, something like
yeah.
that. But there's a little bit of etiquette to this, and I didn't know this, and I found it, and maybe it's a little tongue-in-cheek in the way that this is written, of course, but there's three different versions of the Jeep Wave that you can do. And I've only done one of these, and it was when I was in the North, so as you'll find, it's maybe a little odd. There's one that's a top-off version. So let's say that, you know, you got the top-off on your Wrangler.
Right.
Or your CJ.
Yeah.
This is a one-handed wave above the windshield or
right.
outside of the body tub. So you stick it through the door. It's, you know, invariably missing because, you know, you're taking the doors off your Jeep.
Of course, yeah.
So you stick your hand out and wave. And that's one version. Now, there's also the top-off during a blizzard. Because, of course, you would have the top off during a blizzard because, you know, you always have that top off. And I've seen people drive around like that, you know, when it's snowing. Softly, but you know they still have the top off on the Jeep, or maybe even the doors, because that's it seems to be what they do.
Right.
This version is you would shiver and nod but your hands would remain frozen to the steering wheel. So obviously this is a joke, right? I mean, and then the last one is the southern or rural locations. This is the one that I'm familiar with.
Okay.
This is simply where you raise your fingers from the steering wheel and then you nod. So it's like you can kind of give them like just the two fingers
yeah.
up, or maybe a hand up. And then just kind of like a little nod to, you know, say, I see you over there. And it's become common culture. It's an etiquette thing that they all do. They really do. And if you watch two Jeep owners pass, you'll see it happen.
So are you for it or against it?
I'm against it. I think it's a con. And I'm actually going to say that is one reason that I would protest us buying a Jeep personally. In my own family, because it's just too much to deal with, Ben. It's a hassle.
Are there too many Jeeps, or
I'm just kidding.
Hate waving to people?
I'm kidding. It's not a hassle. It's not too much to deal with. It's something that you just don't think about it at first. And you know, the problem is that when you forget to do it, then you know, 100 yards later down the road, you feel like a jerk because you didn't, and you saw them wave, and you didn't, you know, acknowledge them.
Oh.
And you feel like, yeah. Oh man, I screwed up. So the next time, maybe you're early to do it, and then they forget. Or, you know, it's become one of these weird etiquette things that, and I was only joking about,
yeah.
you know, being a deterrent to buying one. I'm kidding, obviously, but.
Sure.
It's something you gotta consider when you're buying a vehicle, you know, you gotta
yeah.
think. I think, Corvette owners may do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, Monte Carlo owners do not, and I found that out because I would drive by, especially if I saw one that was the same color as mine or something, I would honk and then wave, and I got the side eye a couple times.
Really? Like,
yeah.
Well, what's your problem, huh?
Yeah, just, not necessarily angry, but they were like, I do not know this person who is honking at me, and maybe even didn't think, you know, I'm honking because we drive the same car. How do you indicate that? You know, point at their car and then at yours?
Yeah, I know. It's tough to, unless you get somebody that's in the same spirit as you, you would never do that. Or, I don't know, what if somebody was thinking that, you know, you're trying to indicate to them that...
their light is out or something.
Exactly. There's a problem
a
or something like
lamp.
That. Yeah, I mean, a horn honk just has so many meanings.
Right, yeah.
And a wild hand gesture. Whatever you were doing. Is there a Monte Carlo handshake?
I don't know. There should be one. I feel like a bad Monte Carlo owner now.
Maybe you need to develop one.
Maybe I should just start one, man. We'll take any ideas or topics.
All right,
for that.
So yeah. I went way off topic
we
here.
Did.
You just mentioned the Jeep Jamborees, right?
Oh, yes. They're in Colorado.
And they go back to 1953. So these go way, way back. Now,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about the big Jamboree events that, you know, Jeep owners are invited to come, you know, out to. I think it's open to everybody. That
mm-hmm.
one is. And you're allowed to come in and kind of enjoy your Jeep for what it can do, right? Because you said that this town has all these different trails and different ratings, and you're able to test, your vehicle to the limit, really.
Right. You can tour through the passes, and they've got several different trails, and you can even go on Jeep-led tours.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else who knows the area really well could show you around, and then you can drive around by yourself.
Now, the good news is that Jeep Jamborees are still around. You can still go to Jeep Jamboree, and there's still something else going on, but I want to mention something that happened and then kind of faded away.
Okay.
In 1995, Chrysler, when they still owned Jeep in 1995, they started something called Camp Jeep. And Camp Jeep, which is sort of like a Jamboree, but a little bit different. I mean, it was something that, you know, one of the guys that had taken over the Jeep division, I guess, who recently assigned to it, his name was Lou Bitonti, I believe, or Bitonti.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who kind of came up with the idea. He attended a Jeep Jamboree sometime in the early 90s, and he said, you know, I think that there's something here for Chrysler. We can come up with something that is specific for Jeep owners that Chrysler can put on, not something that's, you know, this nationwide thing. It's something a little bit smaller maybe in its own way. But the early organizers of this whole thing, you know, when you had this idea, they had one important thought that went through their mind the entire time when they were deciding what Camp Jeep would consist of. And they kept asking themselves this question. They said, is this something a Jeep can do?
Mm.
And it was always at the top of their mind is that, you know, how can we push these vehicles to the limit and kind of surprise the owners with what they're capable of doing?
Yeah.
You know, not only the vehicle, but the owner themselves. We want to push the owners to kind of the edge of the envelope. We want them to experience their vehicle to the fullest, you know. And they actually said, we want to take people out of their own comfort zone. We want to let them know that, you know, this is a far more capable vehicle than you thought it was.
Right, because if you're using it as your daily driver, you're not going to encounter the outer limits of this vehicle's abilities.
Exactly right, and it's not just the vehicle again. It's your own abilities, because it's what you feel comfortable doing. And if you have that kind of relationship with your vehicle, it just builds a greater strength. You know, you understand it more. You understand what you're capable of doing yourself as well. And,
yep.
There's a lot of philosophy, I guess, that goes on with that too. But, you know, this comfort zone thing was really big for them. And each day at Camp Jeep was just loaded with activities. And they started in a place called Camp Hale, Colorado. And then they moved to Charlottesville, Virginia later
mm-hmm.
on. But each day you could do things like hiking, or you could go, you know, biking, or you could go mountain climbing. You could do all kinds of crafts, or I think something they called mountain boarding, which I'm not sure exactly what it was. You could take photography classes that were instructed by people from National Geographic. So they brought in, you know, some big names as well. Like at night they would have fireworks displays, and I think, you know, you got to put yourself back in the mid 90s,
right?
But they brought in some celebrities to appear at night, you know, like some music stars. So they bring in like. I think they had Sheryl Crow and Kenny Loggins and people like that would come in and perform. But again, at the time, you know, these were big stars, big celebrities. So that was a big deal. Now by the year 2000, so that's 5 years later, they were getting attendance in the numbers of something like 8,000 people that would
wow.
attend these things.
That's
and it was,
bonkers.
It was a family event. So, you know, like they said that I believe, you know, something like 1,000 of those 8,000 people were under 10 years old. So, you know, it was a family-oriented thing, and people seem to really love it. I don't know exactly what happened to it. I don't know why Camp Jeep faded away, but what they did do is they brought in around the same time something else called Jeep 101. And Jeep 101 is another thing that mm-hmm. is still around. So you can, I guess it's, there's a version of it called, the Jeep Rocks and Road Tour. And that's kind of what Jeep 101 used to be. And I've actually driven on a Jeep 101 course at the headquarters.
Yeah.
At Chrysler headquarters. Yeah, in Auburn Hills, Michigan. And I tell you, Ben, that's a fascinating thing. And if you want to see exactly what it was like, mm-hmm. take a look at the Rocks and Road Tour. You'll find video of it. And the 101 thing was that, again, it just pushed you to do things in this vehicle. Now, you got in with an instructor and you were able to drive. At least at the time you were able to drive on your own. I think now they have the instructor drive with you.
Mm-hmm.
But they show you just how deep, you know, of a water crossing it can ford, or just how steep of a hill it can climb, or how steep of a hill it can, you know, crawl back down. And you would be surprised, Ben, just how it's almost terrifying how steep these hills were on this course. It was really cool. And they would do an articulation thing where, you know, the back wheels would come off the ground when you approach.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
The front wheels would be off the ground as you come off of this thing.
Yeah. Do some rock crawls.
You really would do some amazing things on these Jeep 101 courses. And again, they've developed this into this rocks and road tour. And these things travel around. So like, you know, the Jeep Jamboree, that has expanded now to be something like, there are 30 of these Jeep Jamborees now that happen all over the United States. And these are 2-day events that are held, you know, yearly all around North America. So you can attend one of the 30. And I think the Jeep 101 course is held in something like a dozen or so cities. So they've made kind of a city version of this. You don't have to be out in the country or out in the boondocks somewhere to be able to enjoy your Jeep. Just interesting things that, you know, the company has done with the product and the way that they get the name out there and show the capability, because that's what it's always been about, is a capable design.
And it pays off. That's well said, Scott. And it pays off because I have a little bit of a current event from our news corner.
Oh, yeah. Bring it on, Ben. I'd love to hear it.
Okay. So here we go. This is a story from the LA Times, published July 2nd, so just yesterday as we're recording this.
All right.
Jeep, Subaru, and Rolls-Royce are the auto sales winners so far. They're among the fastest-growing car brands through the first half of the year. So even now, Jeep is one of the fastest-growing brands. Guess which three are struggling the most? This might mess with your mind a little.
Really? Boy. You mean a huge, like big brands?
Yeah.
I'm going to say General Motors, Ford, and I don't know, Fiat.
Mini, Volkswagen, and got that last one right, Chrysler specifically.
No kidding. Now, that's strange. And I just threw that in there, and I thought there's no way that one would be right because, as we know, Jeep is owned by Fiat, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a weird mix.
Yeah, Jeep is leading the charge here. Sales are up 45%. They sold almost 333,000 vehicles during the first half of the year.
Wow.
Yeah. So it went past Chrysler and Dodge. You know, those are the other brands the Chrysler Group owns. So today, the world's oldest off-road brand has 4.1% of the U.S. sales market.
Wow. And we're talking 74 years after this was invented. I mean, this is 74 years later, and we're still looking at a vehicle that, I mean, if you look at it, it looks like the version that was out there 74 years ago, only it's much stronger, much bigger and better.
Yeah.
But you can see the lines from that original 1940 Jeep design in the current JK models that are out there.
Yeah, and so we thought this was just a fantastic topic to explore. But also, Scott, I hate to say it, we're almost drawing to the close of our show, and there's stuff we haven't gotten
to yet.
You know,
there's still more, and there's always going to be more, Ben. I mean, we've crossed off most of the stuff on our list, but as I said, you know, dig into this topic yourselves, because there's so much more to cover here that we just can't simply get to in, you know, the span of a couple of podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
As we found just item after item that was like, oh man, I've got to mention
more
that
more
as well.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. You know how many times in this podcast we said, oh, just one more thing or, you know, oh, here's a sidebar, a side note and, you know, interesting historical facts, things like that. There's just, it's loaded with those. I mean, you can even look into the buildings where, you know, the Jeep engineering happened, you know, the Plymouth Road complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just looking at photos of that. That's now been closed down. So that's kind of another little side note, I guess, if you want to take it that way. Go on the Alpar site and look at, you know, the way it was and the way it is. And, oh man, Ben, that was I'm thinking of more things as we go.
We didn't even talk about the customization of Jeeps, which is huge. And there's some people doing some impressive things out there.
And here's the kitchen appliance tie-in again. Remember the Kelvinator brand?
Yeah.
With AMC? That was right there at the Plymouth Road complex. So that's, again, Jeep engineering was happening at a factory where they were dealing with kitchen appliances. And that tie-in comes in so often. When
yeah.
we talk about cars.
That's kind of inside history. Baseball for longtime listeners of our shows. Every so often, they're in one of our episodes, usually an historical episode like this one, one of us will say, well, You know, they also made refrigerators.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And this Kelvinator thing, I think that's coming up a couple times for the same one, but I guess I'm cheating a little bit on that one. But, you know, there's little bits and pieces like that here and there. And, you know, you'll find out that, you know, maybe they auctioned off the world's oldest Jeep or something like that. You know, there's mm-hmm. always news stories popping up about Jeep and Jeep products. And there's an endless supply of topics here.
So as hard as it may be to believe, Jeep did not pay us to do anything like this. We're just that big of fans of this brand. But Scott, that's something that happens too whenever we do one of our history podcasts. You know, I remember for a couple of weeks after we did the Honda podcast, I was walking around, I would see a Honda drive by and I would think, people just don't understand. People just don't get how deep that brand goes.
You have any idea the history that you're driving there? they just don't get it. Yeah, and I think you know the way it sounds, you know, it sounds like we're almost doing a commercial for Jeep, but that's not the case. And we've had to say that many times in other podcasts. But once you start digging into these and you're researching them for a week or two or whatever we're talking about, it seems like we just get so deep into the subject that we become cheerleaders for the brand or for the make or model.
Endlessly fascinating. Now, we don't do it all the time because we, you know, the DeLorean, the Dale car, when things go wrong, we do our due diligence and show what went wrong. But we are fans of Jeeps and we are fans of these explorations, these sort of nose-to-tail explorations of a car company. So as we head out with... We did pretty well, Scott. We didn't get to everything, but we got to a lot of stuff.
74 plus years of a vehicle, and I think we covered it in, what, less than 2 hours, so not bad.
We'd like to hear your Jeep facts and Jeep trivia. Go ahead and send it to us. We'd also like to hear any suggestions for a vehicle or a topic that you'd like us to cover in the future. You can touch base with Scott and I over at Facebook and on Twitter. We are Car Stuff on Facebook, Car Stuff HSW on Twitter. Turns out we're moving up in the world of the internet. We have our own website, carstuffshow.com. Please check that out. You can find every single one of our podcasts there.
Every one of them. So you can go all the way back, nearly 600 episodes.
Yeah, which you can't find all of them on iTunes. And you can send us an email with a suggestion directly. Our address is
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.